From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Newly published research documents the adverse effect industrial chemicals can have on human neurological development. We'll talk with a local scientist about the findings. Then foodie Kyle Cherik makes the case for a Milwaukee food czar to celebrate the high quality of the city's restaurants.
We do it fabulously with festivals, right? We do it wonderfully with sports teams. But we don't do it as a city entity that puts forth amazing cuisine our way.
Writer Michael Perry stops by to share the story of his newest collection of essays.
These are monologues taken from a weekly radio show that I do, Tent Show Radio. And there's 600 to 800 words, and you have to find some way to put a ribbon on it.
And we hear the latest installment of the series, Islands of Milwaukee. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for being with us today. Researchers from Mount Sinai School of Medicine and the Harvard School for Public Health recently published a paper in The Lancet Neurology called Neurobehavioral Effects of Developmental Toxicity. Their research was focused on the disruptive effects that industrial chemicals can have on human neurological development. Cognitive impairments, such as lowered IQs, can be the result of exposure to these chemicals. The article asserts that the number of chemicals recognized to have impacts on brain development have doubled in only 7 years. Research scientist Matt Dellinger, who's with the Medical College of Wisconsin, is immersed in related research. He focuses on health disparities and risks associated with contaminants, particularly among Native American tribes and rural populations. Dellinger told WUWM's Susan Benz that one of the neurotoxicants discussed in the review, mercury, is still a prominent contaminant in the Great Lakes, despite long-standing awareness of its health risks.
It basically goes hand in hand with carbon dioxide emissions because it's an industrial pollutant, and it's a global pollutant. So if they're burning coal in China, not only are we getting those excess greenhouse gases, we're getting excess mercury, and it's global. It goes everywhere. So goes the fossil fuels, goes the mercury. In the case of PCBs, which is another chemical that they discuss, and again, they review other studies that look into these types of observational studies I describe. That's a chemical that is produced as part of manufacturing. It was used in transformers. I think it's a story a lot of people would be familiar with. And PCBs were banned because of, for similar reasons to mercury, they found out that it had these very negative health consequences, that it accumulates in the food chain, particularly the fish, and it gets, even if it's at low levels in the environment, like mercury and like a lot of the other contaminants that they discussed. It will accumulate up to higher, like fish, for example, and then suddenly you have a dose that's biologically meaningful. So they banned it. And our research with the tribes shows that those bans worked. So when those chemicals were disallowed from production, they went down in the Great Lakes. And that's the kind of, actually, that's the kind of message we're trying to show. The same seems to be true for certain flame retardants. When they ban them, they go away. So that would be one point that I would make, is that when that discussion gets to the point of, okay, we're really sure that PCBs, for example, are bad for your health. We're pretty sure that everyone's getting exposed at meaningful levels because of bioaccumulation and because it gets out, because it's pervasive and persistent. So we should ban it. So they ban it and it goes away, kind of, over a period of time. The excessive exposure for the humans for PCBs and for mercury, two of the contaminants that we're focused on in the study, the primary source is through fish. That's generally accepted to be the primary way that it gets into the humans. Now, the source, industrial source of mercury is coal runoff. It'll leach out of freshly flooded soils. It's everywhere. And also taconite mining, which is an issue in Wisconsin now. That produces more mercury. And so that's all the different areas that the chemical originates from. The way it gets to us, in the case of mercury and PCBs, is generally through fish. In contrast to PCBs, for example, which have been banned and which have been dredged out of like Green Bay and the Fox River, for example, mercury in the fish is increasing, according to our data, because we still burn coal. Other countries still burn coal. And as I said, it's a global contaminant. A lot of the mining industry in Minnesota has contributed to global outputs of mercury. And if we open more mines, for example, in Wisconsin up by the Bad River watershed, that will contribute more mercury. With certain contaminants, we can ban their use. We could ban certain pesticides. There are other, I didn't mention, but there are other pesticides that are decreasing. DDT is decreasing in the Great Lakes, although it's still used elsewhere. Mercury is a little bit more complicated because it's related to a lot of the energy-based activities and mineral extraction activities that we do in society. That's it's obviously important for industry. And so it's important to note that regulations, A, they can work depending on the chemical, and some of the chemicals discussed in the paper, simply banning them through the proper discussion and legislation probably is the right answer. Mercury, there's some trade-offs that need to be considered. The best example I have is the taconite mine that's being proposed to be put in northern Wisconsin. And so taconite processing of the pellets releases mercury from the minerals, from the ore and the rock that they've gathered. And it also increases the need for energy. So the energy required to process all those pellets has been estimated to be, I think it was double or even quadruple, what the local Ashland power plant can produce. So they're going to have to increase that output somehow. And oftentimes that output is in the Midwest and in America is with coal. And so coal is another source of mercury. And so it's complicated. You know, it's complicated. It's a global contaminant. It's vexing. That's why mercury is so vexing, because it's always going to track with burning of fossil fuels. And it's also, in terms of exposure, mercury is going to track with omega-3 fatty acids, which is actually counteracts a lot of the negative effects of mercury. In fact, there are some papers out there that use very similar logic that is cited here to look at those IQ points, look at visual memory recognition in children, and take the increase of score from eating fish and getting omega-3 fatty acids in the children and in the mothers, and then the decrease in score from the mercury contamination that is obviously associated. And there are some interesting calculations that come out of it. The Connecticut Department of Health Services has recently come out with an interesting quantification where they'll show how basically shark, because it's low in omega-3s but higher in methylmercury because it's a shark, it's the top of the food chain, it's not worth it in terms of your visual memory recognition score or your IQ score. You end up in the negative because of your mercury risk compared to the benefit of omega-3s. So this is added layer of complication where these are important sources of nutrition, but if we undermine them by contaminating them with this pollutant that comes out of almost, you know, to exaggerate a little bit, everything we do and then goes everywhere, it requires a discussion that is even larger than should we just ban XYZ. It's a discussion that is, do we support more mining? Do we want more power plants? Do we want to pay the price today of trying to be more efficient and reduce our emissions of these things to try to prevent the loss of IQ points in the future? And that's really the core argument that is being made in this paper.
In this review, the two authors point to several recommended strategies to address the problem. What did you make of those?
In the context of the paper, it sounds incredibly straightforward, of course. So they lay out their argument here. So essentially what they're saying is we have these six well-known neurotoxicants. Here's all the different ways you can slice it, and you can say on average in these populations, if you have this much, you can expect this much loss of IQ points, this much cost to society, and it all works very great within that context. So in a sense, yes. The specific recommendations are have a clearinghouse for studying these things, you know, because the next step they're saying is that there are thousands, tens of thousands, not just thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands even maybe. We don't really know. Chemicals that are out there that we're exposed to every day. And there's a lot we're never going to know about our relationship to these chemicals in terms of our health. And at a certain point, you have to say, well, A, we need to have a proactive approach to studying it and to identifying which are going to be the really nasty chemicals that probably should be banned. And B, we need to maybe think about this a little bit differently in terms of, do we want to treat these new products or these chemicals or even the ones that have been around forever? Do we want to treat them as innocent until proven guilty? So obviously I'm alluding to the trade-off between economy and jobs and pollution, which is going to be, I think, the kind of the backdrop for all of these discussions. And it's you can't really dance around it. You can only dance around it for so long before it basically it's really all a societal discussion about how concerned are we about these IQ points that we're going to lose, or are we more concerned with the economic gains? Now, another way you could put it as a risk assessor is you could consider that in some cases, perhaps, when an activity goes forward that is likely to result in pollution, the gains for that activity are much higher for those who for certain folks who are promoting it and have a lot to gain, whereas those in the area, such as perhaps the Native Americans who use these watersheds in North America, or any of us who rely on the environment, the risks to the others are maybe a few IQ points. Maybe there's a lot of IQ points, but that pales in comparison to how much money can be made in certain circumstances.
Matt, you've said that despite the fact that you study, this is your field of study, you're a parent, you're a dad, you have a couple of children, that you struggle with choices and decisions for your family.
Yeah, well, so the most striking aspect of this to me, of this field that I'm supposedly an expert in, I will sit down and read a paper like this, and I study this day in and day out. I do it professionally, and I'll look at the original sources, the original studies. I'll see them make a claim about IQ points or about dollars, and I'll think, wow, that's very interesting. I wonder how they calculated that. I'll go and I'll look, and I do have the expertise to understand that. At the end of the day, it's still very, very difficult for me to know how to protect my kids. I can go to the store and I have a pretty good idea of which fish to buy. I know that I want fish for my children. It's important for them to develop their brains with the correct building blocks, and fatty acids are important. And but I know that fish can be contaminated. And it's hard for me, even I can't even imagine if someone didn't study this all day, how they would navigate this and really be effective in managing their exposures. And in fact, that's an area of study I'm interested in, is trying to figure out what behaviors really are protective. Because I suspect that that it's very difficult to come up with protective behaviors to really safeguard ourselves. So if the experts are confused and the experts are worried about protecting their own kids, it's a little bit unnerving.
Matt Dellinger is a research scientist with the Medical College of Wisconsin. He specializes in human health and ecological risk assessment. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. You can find a copy of the Mount Sinai Harvard School for Public Health review that Dellinger spoke about on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, we'll visit the sixth floor of the University Club when we join Wisconsin foodie and Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik for a discussion of all the great food trends in the state. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, and I'm Bonnie North. Every month, we talk with Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik about Milwaukee's and Wisconsin's great food traditions. Over the last year, we've covered farmers markets, new restaurants, James Beard nominations and awards that recognize Milwaukee chefs, and more. Well, last week, Cherik gave a talk at the University Club in Milwaukee, and we took the opportunity to record this month's conversation with him there. So we sat down on the sixth floor of the club, overlooking the city that Cherik is so passionate about, and I asked him a bit about his background and how he came to be the Wisconsin foodie.
You know, it found me. The story of how the show came to be a Wisconsin foodie was that the executive producer, Arthur Ersink, was a neighbor of mine. For years, we were in the same building in Walker's Point. We knew each other, but only anecdotally. And he had moved. I was simplifying my life. And he traveled with his then-girlfriend, now wife, and they sketched out what the show would be on a napkin after a great dinner, because that's how you start a show called Foodie. And he turned to her and said, I don't know who will host it. And she said, why don't you ask Kyle? And I had had a big civic sort of imprint at the time, or was trying to get one. And so he got together with me, and we had a drink at Hinterland. And he pitched me, and I said, it sounds great. I don't know if I'll be any good at it. I don't know if you're any good at what you do. But long story short, we shot a pilot. We took it to the Hearst Argyle affiliate. They said, we love it. We want four of them. They put us on during ratings month, which is a blessing and a curse, because ratings month is in May. And they put us on at 11:30 on Saturdays, which, if any Midwesterner hears that, knows that that is the worst time to be doing television, especially for a new show to premiere, because only shut-ins are inside if it's sunny at all on a Saturday in May at 11:30. Yet we had great ratings, and it just sort of went from there, and eventually PBS jumped on, and then that grew us into, you know, about 8 million people if they turned on their televisions all at the same time to watch the show, which is a huge blessing. It isn't that big of an audience, maybe a million something, but it's a privilege. And we get to tell the true, honest, forthright, unsung stories of how dynamic Wisconsin is, which is not a state that does a lot of bandstanding. Yet we provide for, as far as ingredients and talent for the rest of the country from a culinary aspect, so dynamically and so thoroughly and have for so many decades that it's almost become second nature to us.
Go back a little farther, though. You, Kyle.
Yes.
When did food kind of become the thing that you thought, I want to do something with this? Were you always interested in fine cuisine or where foods came from? Or did that evolve as you grew up?
Well, you don't think you are, but your environment sculpts you without you being aware of it. So I grew up in a Hungarian family, and my mom was an exquisite cook. And she would, about once a month, lay out these incredible fine china and that sort of thing. So that, for lack of a better term, home escoffier experience was something that I was exposed to. Her mom, my grandmother, was also an amazing cook, and I spent time in their home, somewhat raised by in early years. And then my dad's mom, who came from a Polish immigrant experience. I mean, all of the salient memories I have of all of the women in my life that raised me were doing things. And this is not uncommon, around food. I remember making sausage with my dad's mom. I remember throwing these dumplings into a steaming pot with my mom's mom, that sort of thing. And then in my own family, when my dad remarried, there were farmers on both sides. So I was cutting the heads off of chickens at the age of 9, baling hay, milking cows in a very small working family farm. That was part of the normalcy of my experience. And growing up in Waukesha, you know, Golden Guernsey just closed for a number of reasons, but because an investment banking firm just didn't find that model viable. But we would drive past this huge two-story statue of a cow. And people in my classrooms, it was not uncommon in grade school to be sharing desk space with someone whose family made a living in an agrarian capacity. So where my food came from was a given. There's the raw milk debate. We grew up drinking raw milk from my brother-in-law's farm, skimming the cream off, having it for dessert. We're all alive, you know.
And quite healthy.
A huge family. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I have all the eyelashes I'm supposed to. So without knowing that, that was part of my experience, and it definitely shaped me. So as the television show Wisconsin Foodie moved forward, these stories were more than familiar to me. They were part of me. To have the blessing of being comfortable and unawkward and at home on a farm when we would go and meet those people was something that I had always taken for granted because it was just how I had to fill my summer days. Part of what I'm in awe, though, is the alchemy of chefs. I mean, I get the farmer experience, to be honest. The thing that has really, really driven me is the commitment that chefs have to make. It's a 10-year process or 12-year to be finished, and it's a craft. It isn't easy. You don't get rich. There's very little celebrity except for a handful, even within the pantheon that we have in media now. And you have to sleep, eat, breathe, love it, or you'll wash out. So farming is the single most difficult way to make a living, right? Because you have to be a meteorologist, an economist, a day laborer, a plumber, an electrician, a, you know,
geologist,
on and on and on, yep. All the time at any moment. A chef has got to give themselves over wholeheartedly to that craft, has to constantly make themselves uncomfortable to progress. So if you learn one style of cuisine, you'll stop being challenged by it eventually. I mean, you can dig into French or Italian or any of the great cuisines your entire life, but to really be engaged, you have to throw off everything you've just learned and start in a new path. That's profound to me.
Did you find that when you were first starting the show and you were thinking about what it was going to be and how it was going to showcase Wisconsin cuisine, were the chefs resistant to you initially, or did they welcome you in?
No, everyone welcomed us in. I think they were trying to figure out what we were, and we were. We knew to a greater extent. I mean, the show was always about where your food came from. It was shot to never look local, and it was going to be shot in a documentary or verite style, and it was not going to be personality driven. So even though I'm the host, I always say I'm the Greek chorus. I'm there to support these dynamic stories. It isn't, hey, look at me. And that's how it should be, because this state and these people and the ingredients and their stories and the terroir is really the story. But they welcomed us. I mean, I still get goosebumps, and I have to give props to Bartolotta, who got it early on. Our first season, they invited us in, and in our first couple of months, I was standing there with Jacques Pepin. Years later at Kohler Food and Wine, when he was getting ready, prepping for one of his demos with his daughter, all of the chefs on the property were standing around the doorway of the tent watching what he was doing. He's a master. He's a French and American treasure. And there I was 4 months into filming, standing there talking to him. That's pretty cool.
So the chefs seem to be interested, and the farmers seem to be interested in telling stories. Do you ever find anybody in your travels around the state that really doesn't want the publicity?
Only one. The episode was going to be called Field of Dreams Pizza. There's some folks over in the Driftless region that live on a essentially sustainable farm, and they have built their own massive pizza ovens. They light them on, you know, let's say Monday, I think, and then they bake on Wednesdays. And people drive from miles around and pull into their field, and they just make whatever they make, but they make several hundred pizzas. And the New York Times had touched on it. We reached out to do a story about them, and they said, we don't want you here. We don't want the publicity. You'll change what is special about this. We want people to hear about it organically. We don't want it to be overcrowded. Please don't come with your cameras. And we totally respected that.
Do you think that there's some of that attitude? What we were talking about earlier in the breakfast, about the seeming unwillingness of Milwaukee to blow its own horn, to actually stand out. Do you think there's a little bit of that? Like, don't ruin this. We have something special going on. We don't want everyone else to come in.
I don't think so. I think we're just bad at, I think we're just bad at blowing our own horn. I don't think that we want to preserve it in amber. There isn't a restaurant in the city that I know of or a local purveyor that wouldn't be happy with more sales, more appreciation, or more butts and seats, quite frankly. Every restaurateur has got the same complaint that on the whole, Milwaukee eats between 7 and 9. And they'd love for that to change with more people that have to wait to get in. I just think there isn't a cohesion of that story being told, and we're just not used to it. We're not used to it. We get A's, we come home, we put the report card on the dining room table, and we just do our homework, because that's how you keep getting A's. We don't think, this belongs on the fridge. Hey!
Or somebody else's fridge.
Yeah, or somebody else's fridge. This belongs in the window near the street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do we bring in the other parts of the city? We alluded to that again in the breakfast, where we have a lot of segregation. We have a lot of disparate neighborhoods, some that don't feel like they're part of the city, or they're a part of the city that we don't connect with very easily or readily. We all need to drink water. We all need to eat. How do we include those other neighborhoods?
Well, a couple things. When I do this TED-style talk in March here at the U Club as well, one of the things that I'm going to put forth is a concept of a food czar, which I'll elaborate on more, but connecting basically the safety requirements, the permitting, all of that jazz, the restaurant scene, and then the sustainability stuff that we've got going, which is dynamic, some of the water, and then just the general food systems that we have here. It's a multi-billion dollar industry in southeastern Wisconsin, what we package and prepare and process as far as things that are called food. So pulling that all together and someone that can shuttle diplomacy between all of those disparate parts. As far as the neighborhoods, to be honest, I think it's just those neighborhoods deciding to want to be part of the city. It's a little bit about what we talked about in the breakfast this morning with my fiance and I. It's a choice. You have to commit. You can say, well, this is our silo, and this is how we eat here, and this is what we do, and if more people would just come here. But you also have to say, we're a broader city. We're a patchwork quilt, but we're all connected. We do it fabulously with festivals, right? We do it wonderfully with sports teams, but we don't do it as a city entity that puts forth amazing cuisine our way. Our chefs are cooking out ahead of the rest of the country as far as what the coasts are concerned.
Elaborate on that a little bit.
So,
in what way?
So from a flyover state perspective and the way that the food media is moving, there's this big push to codify and pump up Midwestern cuisine. And the folks that are in charge of those stories and that perspective like to think that canning is becoming hot. Everybody's been doing it. I mean, people in New Hampshire have been doing it, right? We've all, as long as glass has been industrialized and we could close and seal it, whether it was just with a wax paraffin or some other great technology with a rubber seal, we've been doing it. But the ridiculousness that the national food culture has grabbed onto that as an aspect of Midwestern cuisine is a way that they will define us. Now, we've been thinking far more engagingly about aspects of cuisine like that for much longer, but we need to start defining that story for them.
How do we get them to listen? We have these great resources and we have this amazing cuisine that's ours, but how do we get it out there?
Well, I can't speak to the greater Midwest, but as far as Milwaukee, to have a point person or people or a department that reaches out to those media outlets and says, do you know this is dynamic, or coordinates. I mean, so we've had some great New York Times touches, Esquire touches, Travel and Leisure touches over the last 6 months that have talked about the cuisine. Someone from the Times came here and said, a day and a half in Milwaukee, and they ate at the Art Museum, and they essentially said, why is this so inexpensive for this caliber of great food in this great building? We don't get it. To have a little bit more of a shouting at one or two people on staff or a voice, I'm no good at administration, but that basically puts that outward. That is our own billboard.
Do you see any type of cuisine that we need to see more of here, that you'd like to see more of, that chefs aren't doing?
That's a great question. I mean, we're not as ethnically diverse as other cities, and we're not as ethnically diverse as other cities. So I'd love more ethnic cuisine. I don't know, to be honest, I don't know if Milwaukee has the populace, the dining interest to support them. And that makes me a little sad, but it's also who we are. Most restaurateurs complain about how this city eats between 7 and 9, but more and more and more places are busy after that. And there's a dining population that's developing that eats that late or thinks of going out that late. And so that's starting to change. And in that aspect, we're catching up to the rest of the country, which is good. But remember, so many restaurants have opened up in the past 2 years and then in the past six, and we talked about it on the show. There was just a need. We were underserved by options. So I remember when Hi-Hat opened, and what would that be? 97, maybe, 98. And Mike Idle, one of the owners, said, you know, we're going to have a late night menu and we're really going to take on Elsa's. Well, Elsa's, Hi-Hat, and Ma Fisher's were our three options. I mean, this is not exactly an exciting scene. Now, that has changed precipitously since then. Where do we go for a past 10 o'clock bite? You know, we rattle off names in the car as we're thinking about this. Oh, I don't feel like that. Oh, this would be great. I don't know. Is this person bartending there? Like, that's the good news. So that aspect has changed. But I don't know what trends per se are coming. And it's hard to say what I wish we had. I haven't thought about that. More diversity per se with ethnic dining. But then you've got to have people that will reach out and really, like, can we have a true argument in this town about the best Ethiopian? I don't think so. You know, maybe the best Thai, but that's fairly...
Or best Indian.
Or best Indian, yeah. But those are sort of American ethnic cuisines, right? So to go further, you know, I mean, can we argue about the best Catalanian cuisine between three restaurants? Probably not. And probably never here. But that's okay.
But a little taste of it,
yeah,
is good.
Would be great.
Yeah.
Would be great.
As always, Kyle, thanks for the chat, and we will catch you next month.
Right on. See ya. Let's go get a meal.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is host and producer of the public television show Wisconsin Foodie. He also writes a regular column for Milwaukee Magazine's website. This month, we spoke to him from the sixth floor of the University Club. We'll take a quick break now, and then Wisconsin writer Michael Perry stops by to talk about his latest collection of essays. We'll catch up with him when Lake Effect returns next on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. Writer Michael Perry has fans both around these parts and far from his home state of Wisconsin. His past books have told the story of his time as an EMT around the small town of New Auburn, Wisconsin. We've learned about his adventures in raising chickens and two daughters, and his friendship with a unique cannon-building neighbor in western Wisconsin. Michael Perry's latest book is a collection of essays, some of which are reminiscent of his work in those earlier books, and all of which are caused to pause and reflect on life in the upper Midwest. The book, called From the Top, was culled from short monologues included on the syndicated radio show he hosts from the Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield and from his regular column in the Wisconsin State Journal. Michael Perry joined Mitch Tyke in the studio in December to catch up on things and said it was challenging to say what he wanted to say in only 800 or 1,000 words.
My books are anywhere between 75,000 to 125,000 words. Magazine pieces I do are usually 6,000 to 10,000 words. And even most of my essays are knocking on that territory. Whereas here, these are monologues taken from a weekly radio show that I do, Potential Radio, and there's 600 to 800 words, and you have to find some way to put a ribbon on it in 600 or 800 words. So it has been a challenge. It's been one of those nice challenges. It's fun. I say sometimes if you're going to play tennis, you got to put up a net. And here you just have this space, and it's not about your ego or anything like that. It's just a fundamental element of doing a show of that nature. You only have so much time.
Well, I would think the nice thing is it's a lot easier to throw out a 600 or an 800 word essay and start over than to say, oh my God, I've gotten 5,000 words into this and I hate it.
Well, yeah, although that part's interesting because the other thing it's taught me, I'm an obsessive revisionist and I just love to sit with a line over and over sometimes for a day and my books are very dense and very polished. And when you're writing a weekly, whether it's a newspaper column, which I do that too, you know, I do a newspaper column for the Wisconsin State Journal, and I do these weekly radio monologues, you do the very best you can. You always try to keep the reader or the listener in mind and keep asking yourself, are they still with me? Is this still funny or heartfelt or interesting? But you have to also finish it and just get on to the next one. And so it's been good for me in the sense that I can't obsess over perfection. You just have to try and tell the story and then start telling another one. So,
but you also write, actually, one of the essays in this book is about being overcommitted to stuff. And just one more thing that's keeping you from, I don't know, re-caulking the bathroom.
Yes, and my wife and I have had a couple of family meetings about that this year, collegial and all. But you do have to constantly decide. And in my case, I've gotten in the habit, because I've been freelance for over 20 years now, you just never know where your next gig's coming from. Even now, I have a certain amount of uncertainty built into what I do. And so you do get in the habit of never turning down anything and just always working with one eye on the 6 months out. And at this point, I am fortunate enough that I have several opportunities. And you do have to start cutting a few things out here and there. And for me, that's been trying to find a little more time to arrange just solid blocks of extended writing time. I still write every day, but I'm looking for, can I put in 3 weeks without going on the road?
You've written a lot, and we've talked before about your relatively late entry into the world of more popular music.
Yes.
how you really didn't hear much when you were young, and then there's this Waylon Jennings story. So today, in the course of doing this radio show and your work as a musician yourself, you get to rub shoulders with more than a few musicians of renown. How do you see your kids growing up with all this music around them?
It's one of those situations where you want to expose them to things but not shove anything at them. And the example I've been using lately is I was privileged this past year to be allowed to write the liner notes for the new Blind Boys of Alabama album. And part of that came about because they recorded the album in all places, Falkirk, Wisconsin, rural Falkirk, Wisconsin, quite literally a couple of cornfields away from our farm. And over the years, I've known and worked with a guy named Justin Vernon, who went on to – he had a little band called Bon Iver, won a couple of Grammys. Used to be in my band. He'll come crawling back someday, I'm pretty sure. But he, as a result of some of his successes, has been able to build a pretty nice studio out there in the country. And so the Blind Boys came to record there. And it was a cold winter night, and I was able to take my then 12-year-old daughter with me. And we just watched a recording session, and she was able to watch an octogenarian gospel singer from the Deep South singing gospel music in real time, 20 feet away. And she was so moved on the way home, she just said, I'll remember this night for my whole life. And those are the things. I don't expect her to go buy everything that the Blind Boys have recorded. I don't expect her to become an expert on gospel music. But I just hope that, you know, she'll be back checking out Miley and listening to dubstep and explaining dubstep to her father, which she tried to do the other day. But it will be informed by what she saw. I think it's like so many things in life as a parent. You never know if you're doing the right thing, but you do try to expose them to these things, from singer-songwriters to pop to dance, whatever. And then, of course, I play a little guitar, which is really lame. I play guitar with all the nuance of a man cutting brush.
Well, but I wonder if, given your contribution to the Blind Boys of Alabama, their latest CD, I wonder if there's something to the idea that maybe your daughter grows up to be the kind of person that reads the liner notes.
Well, that would be nice. She ought to, because they're paying for her braces. So yeah, I hope so. Who knows, of course, what liner notes will be in that time. But you do speak to the idea of curiosity. And I think curiosity – and you know, I heard Neil Gaiman say something great one day about kids should be bored. And I agree with him, because he talked about how when he was a child, all his most creative thinking came from when he was bored stiff, because you were forced to come up with something. And nowadays we just so – desperately afraid of anybody not being completely occupied at all times, and kids especially. And so our poor kids, they get bored sometimes, and they'll say, I'm bored. And we go, oh, that's good. You better figure out something. And it is not necessarily digital. So I hope that she'll just have that curiosity and go looking for things like that, sure. And I think also to see – I love to take her – to see shows and see recording, not so she can watch the artist, but so she can watch, look, there's a girl over there who makes her living traveling around the world doing electronics. There's a stagehand. Up at Big Top Chautauqua, the woman who runs the stage, you're watching a professional, a strong woman who makes sure that we're all where we need to be. And so to come to understand the idea that entertainment is not always about the person in the spotlight, but that there are just so many ways to find your way in this world.
But in this collection, you also write that you wouldn't mind if your kids learned to play guitar.
Yeah, because I think, and I can't quote myself exactly, but I've known some women who can play guitar. And generally, women who can play guitar don't take much off you. And I said, they don't put up with stuff. And if guy doesn't treat them right, they don't put up with it. And I also say that when they are mistreated by some guy, they write a song about him and they run him out of town in perpetuity.
Let me ask maybe an indelicate question here. I feel like you've written before about the many things you have read in, and we'll be blunt here, bathrooms.
Yes.
I feel like on some previous edition of the show,
yes,
you quoted the side of a toothpaste.
What it says on the back of the toothpaste right. tube, sure.
Is there some readerly karma in the fact that you have this book that might be fitting just that bill for some people?
I'm happy, man. I've done a lot of reading there. I'd be happy if you did. I don't have any problem talking about it. This is a collection of short pieces. And when I say short, 600 to 800 words is real short. Seems to me to be perfectly suited for that sort of reading. I did see someone just tweeted a picture of the book up in their deer stand. And, in between checking for deer, you maybe can read a quick little essay. So, no, I have no problem with that. I'm just happy to have anybody read me anywhere at any time.
I remember what a revelation it was to find out what that hole was for in the corner of the Farmer's Almanac. The idea that it would be hung up in a place like a—
That's right. It's for the hook. And I'm looking here. I'm just quick checking in the margins here. You could quite easily take this book out to the drill press and sink a hole through it for that hook in the bathroom or the outhouse and not destroy any of the text. So I would— Matter of fact, maybe in future we'll start doing that for my book.
We're having this conversation as people are getting into the holiday season. We're talking in fairly early December. Do you have your Christmas tree yet?
I do not, but it's on the list. I'll be doing it either— Well, it won't be tonight because it's going to be dark by the time I get home. But we'll do it sometime this week because we always try to do it right after Thanksgiving. Yeah.
Yeah. We should. I guess we'll quickly transition into one of the essays here because it's interesting to think as someone who grew up in rural Wisconsin where trees were plentiful. You were not always a Christmas tree guy.
I was not. And there's a piece in the book, this new book From the Top, and it's called Christmas Tree Kids, and it's about my transition from never having a Christmas tree to now. Looking forward to going out this week and cutting one. Whatever the month, we already have our Christmas tree. It's back behind the pole barn. That's where they all are. I was never a Christmas tree guy. In part, this was due to the counterintuitive fact that I was raised in an obscure Christian church so fundamental, the December holiday was viewed as dangerously contrived pagan silliness. So when I was growing up, we never had a Christmas tree in the house. We did get Christmas because my grandma was a believer of a different stripe. She always bought a squat Scotch pine, and some years the pile of presents dwarfed the tree. Later, I left the church and was freed up to get a tree, but by then I was a bachelor and never had reason or interest in dressing or decorating my digs holiday-wise. You got some deer horns and a concert poster on the wall, why mess with the vibe? Plus, based on my housekeeping history, last year's Christmas tree skeleton would still be standing. Also, once, after Grandpa died, I helped Grandma put up her annual Scotch pine, and the whole deal kind of cured me of Christmas trees in general. She had one of those plastic stands with the three screws, and every time I got the tree halfway vertical and tightened one of the screws, the tree would tip over. And just the same as smoke from a campfire always seems to swing around and blow in your face, no matter which screw I was tightening, no matter from what angle, that tree always seemed to manage to fall my way. The needles on a Scotch pine take the term needles very seriously, and by the time I got that blankety-blank tree to stand upright, I felt like I'd been loofed with an overactive porcupine. Oh, and the language, profoundly un-Christmassy. Anyways, for years, I didn't have a Christmas tree. Then I got married, and my wife brought with her a beautiful young girl named Amy, who's now my daughter. To my eternal shame, when our first Christmas rolled around, I still held out. We did decorate the house, but I didn't think we needed a tree. Plus, we were going to visit Grandma. But then we moved to a farm, and there were Christmas trees growing right out back. So the second week of December, we went ahead and cut one. I was reluctant, but Amy's eyes lit right up. She helped me saw it down, drag it in, and put it up. And now come the day after Thanksgiving, I'm the first one lobbying to grab the saw and get out there. We cut last year's tree out on the ridge, Amy taking her turn on the bucksaw, while Jane, our youngest, played in the snow with our black cat. We hauled the tree and the little one back home in a sled. Halfway down the trail, I took a picture of Annalisa and the girls and the tree. In the photo, all three of them are looking at me with blue eyes and smiles, the tree settled on the sled between them. We brought the tree inside and spent the evening stringing popcorn beside the fire and letting the girls take turns hanging ornaments. Later, when Annalisa was putting Jane to bed, I was in the kitchen doing dishes when I noticed the living room lights go out. I looked, and there was Amy sitting sideways in the old overstuffed chair, legs dangling, staring at the lit tree in the dark. You want, in moments like these, to just shut the world down and call it a day. And when I pulled that dishwater drain, that's exactly what I did. Went in and sat with her. That tree was a spruce, short and a tad gappy, although nowhere near Charlie Brown status. But it looked perfectly beautiful glowing in the corner that evening. I got to thinking about how long I'd held out against getting a Christmas tree and how the kids coming along changed things and what lesson I might take from that. And I believe those first Christmas trees taught me that sometimes you need to stop being the man you think you are and start being the man you ought to be. Merry Christmas.
Michael Perry reading his essay, Christmas Tree Kids, from his new collection, From the Top. Well, we are glad, as always, to have you here and come back and see us again. Mike Perry, thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael Perry's latest book is called From the Top, Brief Transmissions from Tent Show Radio. It's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Perry lives in rural western Wisconsin, and he stopped by in December to talk with Mitch Tyke. Perry will be at Books & Company in Oconomowoc at the end of the week on both the 27th and the 28th. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We will take one last break and then hear the latest installment from the Islands of Milwaukee series. That's coming your way next when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Each Monday, we air a segment that's called The Islands of Milwaukee. It's a project that seeks to connect and engage seniors living across the Milwaukee area with a question of the day. Here's the next installment.
The Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towey from the Islands of Milwaukee. A lot of our questions of the day veer towards the philosophical, but this week we have a question that's more pragmatic, a question that received a lot of urgent responses. We're asking, is there an intersection you wish you could cross on foot, but it feels too dangerous?
Yes, there is. Oakland and Locust. There are several in the area where I live. Falwell and Royale, one block west of St. John's.
Forest Home and 43rd. And they have stoplights, stop and go lights, with clearly identified walk signals. The people who are turning from those streets or onto those streets do not pay attention to the walk signs, and they will just cut off a walker. They'll just zoom out in front of you and go past you. So I'm calling to let you know that my path is blocked by inconsiderate drivers on 43rd and Forest Home. And so I'm afraid.
In response to these calls for action, Sojourn Theater and UWM's Theater Department are partnering with South Shore Connecting Caring Communities to create three street performances designed to transform Milwaukee into a city that sees and stops for pedestrians. Look for us on May 1st and 2nd at intersections across Milwaukee. Until then, learn more at islandsofmilwaukee.org.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands Hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned.